So we're left off at the last talk that I did. Was I was talking about the nature of self and emptiness and that sort of thing. And I hear from Kayla that there's at least one person here who says emptiness. How can you get really interested and attracted to the idea of emptiness? It's not really a very compelling notion. So let's see if I can make it more compelling. The Buddha is known to have said that it's very important to not, in your thinking, to not fall to an extreme. The tendency of the mind is to go to extreme views of things. Sometimes this is referred to as overestimating things or underestimating things. For example, when I was in my late 30s, I got divorced and I bought a sports car. And those things were related to each other. This is before I met Kay, of course. And so in my mind, a sports car, because I'd driven nothing but clunkers up to that point, in my mind, a sports car had a certain something associated with it. That's called overestimation. I don't need to go into detail. That was called overestimation. And you can imagine what drove overestimation. So, all right, it was pretty classic. But it was a great car, and Kay and I both loved it, because that's what I was driving when we met. Curious. No. But Kay was driving this Jeep Wrangler. We had the exact opposite kinds of vehicles that we purchased more or less at the same time.
Black.
Right. And I had a white
lots
sports car.
Lots of chrome.
And I had a sleek white sports car with no chrome. Anyway, so that's overestimation. Underestimation is the reverse, which is not giving things enough credibility or credence or importance. It's very hard, from the Buddhist point of view, it's very hard to see things or understand things just as they are. That there's so much of a tendency to not see them as being important enough or see them as being too important in some way. So technically it's called overestimation and underestimation. But it's just really an aspect of what the mind generally does, which is it tends to go to one extreme or another extreme. Now, there's another extreme that Buddhists talk about, which is the mind either tends to go to the extreme of too much, creating too much solidity or reification, or it's called absolutism often in Buddhism, to take things to be too solid and too exactly what they appear to be. And the opposite of that is considered extremely dangerous, actually. It's the extreme of nihilism, which is to not see things as being as important as they really are. So you can see how overestimation and underestimation, absolutism and nihilism, are kind of related to each other in that respect. in the movie Little Buddha, there's a story that's supposed to have come from, supposed to have been in the life of the Buddha. I've never heard it any place but in this movie, but it might be in one of the scriptures someplace because I haven't read them all. Presumably, Shakyamuni Buddha was sitting on a riverbank, and this little boat went by, and there was an older man and a boy in the boat, and the older man was talking to the boy about how to play a musical instrument. And he said, if the string is too tight, it doesn't sound right, and it might even break, and if the string is too loose, it doesn't sound right. But the trick is exact right tension on a string, and then you get the right sound. And presumably the Buddha had this big awakening. Ah, life is like that. You know, it's finding the balance point, the middle, the mean, as the Greeks would say, between the two extremes. So one of the ways in which our mind naturally views things is to see them as being very solid and very permanent, when in fact that's not what they are at all, because everything is constantly changing. And if things were solid and permanent, they couldn't change. Maybe that sounds redundant. Maybe I'm going to have to be very concerned about Mercury and retrograde in a moment. But, so the Buddhist teaching about emptiness, which is actually like one of the critical teachings, is addressing this particular concern. And in Sanskrit, the term emptiness is shunyata, S-H-U-N-Y-A-T-A. And that's sort of the general term, shunyata. But the way it's usually used is to not so much talk about emptiness as an abstract philosophical concept, but to talk about things as being empty, which is to say things are shunya, things are empty. And where the word comes from, where the Sanskrit word comes from, is actually is useful to etymologize it in this particular case. It comes from a root that is also used to is also related to the word gourd. Now, a gourd is something that it has like a shell, but it's empty on the inside. And so the idea of emptiness refers to something that's like a gourd, which seems solid on the outside, but it's vacuous on the inside. And the way it's used in Buddhist thought is that pretty much everything you can think about, you discover, if you look at it really closely, that it's full of your own projections and your own ideas about what it is. And there's actually very little there that you can identify apart from your own projections on what it is. So if we were to kind of go back to my sports car, which I had overestimated the value of. Well, actually, in truth, I suppose I underestimated the value of it. Because I thought of it as being whatever I thought of it as being. And it turned out to be this incredibly safe, reliable vehicle that we drove, the K and I drove for years before somebody pulled out of a blind spot into it and crunched it. We would have driven it forever because it turned out, in spite of the fact that that wasn't the reason I bought it, it turned out to be mechanically a great vehicle. So in that sense, I actually underestimated its value because I overestimated it from another point of view, which was suddenly I was a bachelor and I had a whole different set of ideas about the vehicle. So it was empty of all those ideas that I had about it, but it was full of something else which I hadn't actually recognized because I was busy looking at the wrong stuff. Okay, so most everything is kind of like that, that we look at things and we miss what's actually there because we're so focused on what we think is there. And you could go down a list of all sort of things that are like that. I think owning a house is somewhat like that, for example. It's very hard to be in a relationship, especially in the beginning of a relationship, and see somebody for what they are. And then the problem that occurs is after some period of time, you do begin to see people more, somewhat more for what they are. And then, you know, you have to make an accommodation. This is what I thought. This is what's going on. And, you know, that could be better or worse. I'm not saying it's one thing or the other, but it's certainly different. I suppose there are a few people who get together, and after 5 years or 10 years, you know, the person that they've gotten together with is the person they thought they were getting together with. But I actually think it's probably a rarity. I think it's more often that, you know, there's some other kind of discovery process that's going on, which could be a good thing. You know, I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's different. You know, but it's probably always different. Well, no, it's probably mostly different. I don't want to say always. It's probably mostly different. So, from the Buddhist point of view, one would say that, you know, the person that you married is pretty much empty of all the romantic notions you have about that person. There's a real person there, right? But that probably isn't the person that you married. And then you find out who that person is in time. And most of everything that we encounter is like that. So the concept of emptiness this is sort of a problem to fit into English, because it's usually translated as emptiness, but or voidness, which is a particularly unattractive notion, because as you know, if the actual nature of everything is it's void, that's a very unattractive kind of proposition. But it would be better to talk about devoidness, although it's grammatically really clumsy. It's actually more accurate from the point of view of what Buddhists are talking about, because they're always talking about something in our experience that's devoid of our projections upon it, because we either overestimate or underestimate the characteristics of that thing. You know, you buy something and you think it's just perfect the way it is, and then you have to wrestle with the fact that over time it begins to fall apart, wear out, or whatever the case may be. And the ideas that you have about it when you first buy it don't usually include the fact that it has a limited lifespan, or shelf, not shelf life, a limited, what's the word I want?
Functionality?
Yeah, limited functionality is good. At a certain point it just fails in whatever you think it's going to do. And, you know, this kind of stuff happens all the time. Or you don't, you're attracted to something and you're interested in something, but you're so mesmerized by it, you don't tend to think of what it takes to maintain it, for example. There's just a lot that you end up missing in regards to things because they're glossy or they're attractive in some way and you don't. So, again, the Buddhist lingo would be, they're devoid of, the thing is devoid of the fantasies you had about it. There's a real something there, but it's really different than what you thought it was. And pretty much everything is like that. But we can't talk easily in English about devoidness, but it would be convenient if we could. Now, again, where this becomes of particular interest is in regards to ourselves. Because, again, the Buddhist analysis is that I, as a person, am devoid of most of the characteristics that I associate with myself. And Zachoji gave some really interesting examples of that. He said, you're sitting in a room with 2, 4, 6, 8 people, as we are tonight, each of us, and for each of us, the other 8 people in the room have a certain set of ideas about us. And all 8 of you have a different set of ideas about me. And all 8 of us have a different set of ideas about Kayla. And all 8 of us have a different set of ideas about Jane. I mean, that's just the way it is. And, you know, if we took 5 minutes and kind of went around in a circle, and each person wrote down what do they think about Jane, and then we compared, you know, those descriptions, we'd have 5 radically different descriptions of Jane. Not even from the point of view of good, bad, or indifferent, it's just they'd be different. That's all. And we know that that would be the case. Now, as Rinpoche pointed out, what ends up happening is, because that's the nature of our lives and the way we grow up, we end up trying to fit ourselves into our relationships with other people. Therefore, we have to somehow fit ourselves into relationship with their ideas about us. And so what ends up happening is, you grow up in a family, for example, with a mother, a father, let's say it's a traditional family, a few siblings, so let's say there are 5 people in the family, right? And you're 1 of 5. So 4 of those people have radically different ideas about you, and so you grow up trying to fit into the ideas that 4 people have about you and who you are, and they're all different, and then that's what you take yourself to be, which is 4 contradictory ideas. So now you have 4 contradictory ideas about the essence of who you are. Well, you know that's going to create a problem. And we all have that problem, right? You know, my mother thought I was one person. My father thought I was another person. And my brother definitely thought I was a different person because he was 5 years younger than me. I had a grandmother that lived with us, and she thought I was somebody else. It's like, so who am I, you know? So if we begin to look at those ideas and sort of say, oh, where did that come from? Does that fit? Well, that's not really me, right? There's a me, and then there's all those ideas about me, and you scrape that away, it's sort of like you're emptying yourself of all those ideas about you. Okay. So then, when you empty yourself of all those ideas about yourself, what's left? Well, it's interesting to then find out if you have any of your own ideas about yourself. And you look at what those ideas might be. And that's assuming you can tell the difference between your father's ideas about you, your mother's ideas about you, your boss's ideas about you, your spouse's ideas about you, your kids' ideas about you. If you can find those things and identify them and start saying, yeah, well, that was dad's idea about me. Okay, psh, that's gone. You know, and that was mom's idea about me. Psh, that's gone. And that was my first boss's idea about me. Psh, that's gone. You know, just kind of emptying all that stuff out. Are there any ideas that you have about yourself that didn't come from someplace else? The odds are the answer to that is no. There's probably not a single idea you have about yourself that didn't start someplace else. But let's say that there are some ideas that you have about yourself that didn't come from outside of yourself. And then you look at those, and then it's interesting to ask the question, is that really who I am? Does that describe me? Am I really like that? And the odds are the answer will be no. Because if you really look at who you are and who those ideas are about yourself, I mean, even apart from the ones that have been dumped on you, you probably find that they're not very adequate because they're either overestimating or underestimating the characteristics of you, wherever they came from. And it might simply be that those ideas represent the linguistic conventions of our culture, and that you got put in a box because the English language requires certain boxes to make things work, and you compare your experience with what the language is, and it's kind of like, well, that doesn't fit. And so now you start emptying the language out of its significance for you, right? And then, you know, if you're a Freudian or a Jungian or something like that, you find all this other stuff going around down in your subconscious, and you look at that stuff and you say, is that me or not? You know, that's an interesting question, right? It's like, I'm 64 years old. Do you really think it's true that libido is driving my path through life at this point? Maybe when I was 20, you could say that without any trouble. At 64, I kind of doubt it, you know. So much for Freud. Let's put him aside, you know. See, right? He had some other ideas, too. He had an idea which was Thanatos. You know, which, now, that one might be going on. I don't know. Anyway, the point is, you know, when you start looking closely, you can draw distinctions between all these impulses that are going on within yourself and who you are in the sense of your actual subjectivity. And you start emptying yourself out of all these things. And now you see where emptiness starts having a deeper dimension to it. You start seeing yourself as devoid of all of this stuff, because even if libido is real, you know, and you're a Randy 20-year-old, it's sort of like there's you and there's randiness. They're not necessarily the same thing. You know, I don't think that that's the essence of any 20-year-old. I mean, it's something that happens to 20-year-olds. It's not the essence of who that person is. Although there may be some parents who would disagree with that, but I think that that's the case. Anyway, so then what's left after you've done all of this? Big empty space. There's nothing there. Now, is that nothing there? What is that nothing that's left when you've extracted all those false ideas and so on and so forth? What's left in that space? Again, the danger is overestimation, underestimation, or the absolutist view or the nihilist view. Because now you've got this new experience and your mind wants to put some ideas upon it. But that new experience doesn't really have anything to do with the mind that's trying to put the ideas upon it, right? Because what's left is just whatever you are as a subject, but any ideas that you try and put on that are probably the old stuff that you just got through throwing out. So what can you say about it? Not very much. Except there's a quality of spaciousness to yourself, like empty spaciousness. But empty spaciousness is like vast openness. It's like vast possibilities because there's nothing in there. Because space doesn't impede anything. Space allows anything to go through it. space doesn't have an end. It doesn't have a beginning. It doesn't have a center. It doesn't have a periphery. It's pretty much undefinable. I mean, we understand space because we have this abstract notion about extension and things that are floating in space and whatnot. But if you really get down to it, and I'm not talking about Einstein space-time or something like that, but if you get down to it in terms of space as an experience, not a concept from physics, but space as an experience, if you get right down to it, it's kind of like limitless. I mean, you can't, right? Because the only way you limit, the only way you understand it is to say, you know, you, here's a spot in space, right? So now you've already limited it. And then here's another spot in space. Like, here's an idea about me. So that's going to, that sort of sets something in the space of David. But again, that's limiting it. Okay. So when you've emptied all that stuff out, you're into this vast subjective potential without boundaries that you can't say a whole lot about. Now, one of the things about Buddhism that's been interesting is that it's gone everywhere in the world now. I mean, for a long time it went everywhere in Asia, but in the last 100 years it's now gone everywhere in the world. How is this possible? Well, one of the reasons it's gone everywhere in the world is it doesn't say that. I mean, if you know, Christianity's gone everywhere because it's said that's the truth there. You know, we give a definition, Christ, you know, redemption, cross, all this stuff. That bugs some people because they don't like that, right? I mean, it doesn't go so well in the Muslim world, for example. You know, and Muslims have their own thing, but they've also been very successful globally. But they've all done it differently than Buddhists, because the way Buddhism expanded, and it expanded throughout the entire world, was sort of by saying, take away, take away, take away, take away, take away, and what's left? Well, we can't talk about what's left. We're not going to be specific about what's left. Is that in conflict with Christianity? Well, I don't know. It's just what's left. You know, is that in conflict with Islam? Well, I don't know. Is that in conflict with Allah? I don't know. It's just what's left. Does it look like Allah? If you want it to, that's okay, but that's just another concept. Well, that creates problems too, of course. But it's like, so this end place is this kind of open spaciousness which is undefined. Now, is that an attractive notion? It's not like you can crank up a whole lot of passion about that the way you could about loving Christ, you know? I mean, a lot of people, you know, crank up a lot of personal passion about devotion to Christ or Allah or something like that. And those things are great. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. That's very powerful stuff. It's the bhakti tradition, as the Indians call it. That's very, very powerful spiritual practice. I'm not putting it aside, or I'm not putting it down, rather. But it's different. Because, you know, your mind can't crank up a whole lot of passion about, oh, I'm empty space. But if you can work your way through having that experience and get a glimpse of what that's like, then you get what it was the Buddha was smiling about when they put little smiles on his face and all the statues. Okay. But, you know, the Buddhists don't say this is it. What they do is they say, nope, that's not what it is. And then that opens up the space for allowing it to happen within you. So if you look at it and think, wow, that's not really very interesting, then it's probably because at some level there is the kind of nihilistic thing going on where you're saying, let me put it this way. If you look at it and say, that's not very interesting, you might also be saying something like, that's very uncomfortable. And then that would be sort of the nihilistic thing. If your mind says it's not very interesting, that might be something else. But if your mind says, wow, the void, let me in, then you've gone to the other thing, which is like, you know, that's a great thing. And there are a lot of Buddhists who make that subtle mistake of I'm seeking the void, you know, now, and they seek the void in the sense of understanding it as being tangible. So they're wrong, because they've gone to the absolutist, you know, they've taken this devoidness idea and they've turned it in, they've reified it. The technical term in English means to take something and make it into a thing, to take a process and make it into a thing, to make take an idea and make it into a thing. So they take an idea, which is what's called a hermeneutic. It's a function. It's a technique of looking at things as being devoid, and they've turned it into a thing that one would seek. Well, then they've missed it, because they've just made a thing. And what do we know about things? That they're devoid. Oh, so so voidness has to be void of voidness. Buddhist philosophy gets really interesting. You have to empty voidness of your notion of void and the solidity of void and what's left. That's what the goal is. That's Buddha's smile. Well, no, Buddha's smile is he knows what the goal is. The goal isn't Buddha's smile. That's another reification there. I just slipped right there. Okay. So, again, you have to do this dance between making it too solid and making it too vacuous. And it's someplace between. And it, though, I'm talking about it is you. You know, the essence of what you are is this undefinable something that you find by removing all the stuff that got layered over it. Now, nothing wrong with the stuff that got layered over it in a certain way. I mean, it's the stuff that makes us functional in the world, you know. I mean, all the junk that my mother and father put on me is all the stuff that's given me a professional life and, you know, an income as a result. So if they didn't stuff that stuff into me about who I am, which made me achievement-oriented and, you know, hardworking and get to work before 8 and leave by 5 or leave after 5 or something like that, you know, if I didn't have that kind of stuff within me, you know, we wouldn't be living the way we live, because I have to really work hard to do this. And so I have the internal, you know, ideas, you know, from my culture and my family to do that sort of stuff. And that's fine. Nothing wrong with that. So I'm not saying it's bad stuff. But if I thought that's all I was, which was, you know, the guy that went out 8 to 5, you know, 50 weeks a year, you know, to bring home the bacon, and I thought that was it, that would be pretty small me. And there are a lot of people who think that's what it is, and they end up with a pretty small them. And then there are folks who say, well, okay, you know, that isn't it. But there's a danger there, too, because somehow you have to find a balance point of, you know, getting your worldly thing to work without being trapped by it. And everyone finds that balance point in a different location, you know. And it changes over time, too. I mean, I'm 64, and there's a certain point where I'm not going to be able to do 8 to 5 anymore. In spite of what the stuff is that's in my head, you know, my old bones are just not going to cope with it, right? And so then I have to accommodate to those changes. But the point, I'm getting distracted, that's Mercury in retrograde. The point is that both of these things are important. And I'm not arguing one or the other, you know, that the messages that we've internalized are important for certain things, for worldly convention and getting on in the world, which is typically, by the way, called by Buddhists the conventional truth of ordinarily worldly life. And then there's the ultimate nature of things, which is called that, the ultimate truth of things. And somehow we have to stay in touch with the both of those things if we're going to have a balanced, harmonious life. If we get one without the other, we're generally in trouble. And, you know, there are people who get into the deep ultimate and lose track of the conventional, and that becomes a different kind of a problem. I mean, sometimes we institutionalize it because it becomes so dysfunctional. In traditional Asia, they have monasteries, so they're taken care of. We don't do a very good job with those sorts of things. And I think there are people who run into that.
But when you're talking like that, you're making it sound scary again.
Oh, okay. Am I?
Yeah.
If you lose track of the balance, well, if you lose track of the balance, I think it is scary. I'm not trying to be nihilistic about it. I'm just saying that, you know, when you lose your balance, it's a little problematic. Okay. I'm being extreme. All right. I'm being extreme. I'll cut that out of the recording. I don't mean to make it sound scary. I'm just trying to make the point that both the conventional and the ultimate are necessary parts of life. That's really all I'm trying to say, without being an extremist.
So what is the thing about, the Buddhists say it's like clear light, it's luminous, it's infinite, and it just describing the empty state. They are putting labels on it at that point, right?
Yeah, they are, but they're provisional labels. I mean, they are sort of talking about their own. Spaciousness does have certain characteristics. Spaciousness does have certain characteristics. Sort of luminosity, they would say, is one of the characteristics of spaciousness. Yeah, but when you start putting words into it, like beatific or blissful or full of light or something like that, then those things start meaning something to people, which is probably not what they're talking about. For example, Rinpoche this weekend said, the Dalai Lama generally, when he's teaching, says what people want is happiness, and that's what life is about, is achieving happiness. And then he spent about 15 minutes, or maybe it was an hour, talking about what is happiness and what do people think happiness is. And he went through all the stuff that everybody thought happiness was, and he said that's not what they're referring to. That's not what His Holiness is referring to. And when they talk about the blissful quality of experiencing that spaciousness, all the ideas you have about that blissful quality are not what it is. It's something else. So you could say it's blissful or a beatific experience by way of making it attractive or pointing to it or hinting at what the experience is like, but it would obscure it as much as anything else. So that's why I didn't talk about it this evening, because I'm interested in talking about it as openness, as spaciousness that allows for things to happen, rather than trying to get specific about what it is. I could have gotten specific about what it is, but then I would have misled you in a certain way. So I didn't want to do that. But I don't think that leads to a place of nihilism, because of the analysis that I used to get there, which is the gourd. I'm talking about the space within the gourd. Maybe I'm talking about the space within the gourd. This gourd in my head, I don't know. Anyhow, it's the way I felt like talking about it this evening. I don't think it's going to lead anybody into a nihilistic.
What? Why don't you ask?
All right.
Yeah, for people's responses to that.
All right, you ask.
What is your response to that? How does that make you feel? Does it connect with the practices you're doing? That idea?
It makes me feel potentiality.
Okay, good. That's what it should. Mm-hmm. Good.
Anybody else?
Well, could you connect it to the concept, I don't mean conceptual about it, but just if emptiness is related also to interdependence, mm-hmm. Could you connect that a little bit?
Sure.
I mean, if this concept of spaciousness.
Sure.
Is related.
Sure. They're sort of two sides of the same coin. That would be the short answer. The longer answer, since that probably is not at all adequate, is that, let's see if I can do it. Interrelatedness is usually talked about. In English, we talk about interrelatedness. But the Buddhist language is dependence or dependent origination or things arising in dependence upon each other. I'm sort of emphasizing that because I'm not talking about independent. I'm talking about in, one word, dependence, second word. That everything exists in dependence upon something else. But most people who teach Buddhism talk about interrelatedness because it's a good shorthand. But technically, it means the idea is that everything depends upon many other things. That nothing exists except by depending upon many other things. I mean, the obvious example is that we exist ultimately in dependence upon our parents and their coming together. But we also exist in a moment-by-moment basis in dependence upon the air we're breathing, the gravity that keeps us from floating off into a different kind of space, the kindness of the people around us who employ us, who feed us, who, if we're sick, take care of us when we go to the hospital or something like that. We exist in dependence upon the food that we eat, the water that we drink. I mean, if it wasn't raining and snowing in the Blue Mountains every winter, we would be in serious trouble here. So our moment-by-moment existence is a matter of many factors that support it, because we depend upon those things. But the way we go through our lives on a moment-by-moment basis is that we don't see that. Tomorrow morning, I'll get up, and if I'm in a hurry, I'll fry some eggs and, you know, make some toast or something like that, and I'll sit down and I'll gobble it and I'll run out the door to go to work. If I'm not in a big hurry, I'll sit down and I will think about where those eggs came from, and I'll think about the way those eggs are nourishing me, and I'll think about the seed that was eaten by the chickens that was converted to the eggs, and that the seed was coming out of plants and the plants were the earth. And I'll look at those eggs and I'll see that my body, which is of the earth, is being nourished by the earth in the form of an egg. Now, most of the time, we don't look at that. We just see an egg sitting there, and we don't think about where did it come from, and we don't think about where is it going. We just gobble it up and get up going about our business. So we see it as independent, when in fact it's a dependent phenomenon. Okay. So in order to see it for what it is, we look at, you can almost do this fantasy, if you will, but it's really an analysis. You look at what you know about eggs and where do they come from and how do they get to your plate, let alone where are they going to, which you could also do, but it's simple enough to just do the where's it coming from side, although both sides are useful. When you do that, you're starting to empty the egg of its independent characteristics, its apparent independent characteristics. You're emptying your perception of the egg of its independence, and you're allowing it the dependent phenomenon that's there to show itself forth. Okay. So when you're looking at the dependence of the egg as a phenomenon, depending upon this whole line of events, when you look at the dependence of the egg, you have emptied it of its independence. Okay. That's why I said, really, devoidness is a useful term, because it speaks to the hermeneutic of what you're constantly taking out of experience. It's not like there's nothing there. What's actually going on in your practice is you're taking something out taking something away, which is your own fantasies or your own non-recognition of the truth of what's happening. Does that? So in that sense, they're flip sides of each other. So when you see the emptiness or the devoidness of some characteristics, excuse me, when you see the emptiness or the devoidness of something, you're seeing the way it depends upon everything else. And when you see the way in which it depends upon everything else, you're seeing its emptiness of independence. So it's always, things are always empty of something. They're empty of permanence. They're empty of independence. They're empty of your fantasies about them. Okay, so emptiness speaks to an interactive process of you and phenomena in which you're deploying your own wisdom to see the actual nature of phenomena. That was quite a mouthful. But it's a difficult concept.
Yeah.
It's a very difficult concept. It's the, in a sense, the thorniest concept in Buddhism. And what makes it so difficult is that all of our mental habit patterns are the very patterns that emptiness is meant to unravel, if you will. Okay. I mean, for example, think about all the ideas. Okay, from this point of view, all the ideas that you have about yourself are false. Okay, because every idea that you have about yourself is about David or Tom or Jane or Kayla as a that, which is usually a definitive, solid something. Hold on. If I go through all the ideas I have about myself, I'm a teacher, I'm a husband, I'm Jewish, I'm a guy, I'm an American, I'm a 64-year-old guy, I'm an overweight guy. I mean, run down all these ideas that I have about myself. All of these ideas that I have about myself are specific, concrete, they're concrete references. Even if I say I'm a loving person, which you would think is a dynamic reference to myself, the image that I have of myself as a loving person is of a concrete something in relationship with another person. The image that comes up for me is not a sort of dynamic, emotive something that comes up, but the image that comes up for me when I say I'm a loving person is basically I'm giving my wife a hug. That's the image that comes up for me when I say I'm a loving person. So if you realize that all of those things are wrong, in the sense that they're all nouns, when the reality of who you are is a verb, a dynamic process, if you realize that all the ideas that you have about yourself are wrong, then you also realize that all the ideas that you have about correcting your wrong ideas are also wrong ideas. Right? So, you know, any idea that you end up having about how to solve the problem is also a wrong idea. So now you're in this really stuck place where you're full of wrong ideas, and all the ideas that you have about correcting your wrong ideas are wrong ideas. And when you notice that, then you have to also realize that your thought that you have wrong ideas about correcting wrong ideas is another wrong idea. And there's like this infinite regress where you have no place to stand. And when you finally step outside of that infinite regress, than spaciousness. And then there's nothing more to say about it but spaciousness. I mean, see, even I've said spaciousness. Now what did I do? I just did another one. See, another wrong idea. Because what do we think spaciousness is? But we have to talk about it. The Buddha said, you know, you have to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So you do your best. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't talk about it, then you're not being helpful at all. And this is, language is what we've got to be helpful. The cats can't help each other this way. You know, Manju and Bamboo can't help each other to get free of their own conceptual problems. They do have concepts. Cats have concepts of a type, you know. They construe the world in a certain way. But they can't help each other get free of those concepts because they have no way to share their concepts, to get free of their faulty concepts. Human beings can do that if they're sort of cognizant that they're playing kind of game with each other about these sort of things. Okay. And then that's kind of, you know, that's an interesting place to get to, where you realize that everything that you believe is wrong, because it's all based on false premises. Because everything you believe is about nouns and verbs, when if you really examine closely, there are no nouns, there are only verbs. But you can't think that way. You can't only think in verbs. And if you try thinking in verbs, what you find very quickly is that you're thinking in verbs that end up looking like nouns. You think you're thinking in processes, which we know. The truth of the, I mean, physics makes clear. They're just processes around. They're no things. But your mind, because you're an English speaker, is going to force you into seeing nouns, no matter what you do. You'll end up seeing, like, a big process, and that'll be a thing. You put a box around it, be a thing there. Inescapable, you know, if you're an English speaker. Maybe Navajo don't have such a big problem, because Navajo is a very different kind of language that isn't so stuck on nouns in the way we are. But even there are issues, right? So the great Buddhist philosophers have done analyses of the way in which we misconstrue processes, not just the way we misconstrue nouns, because what we bring to the way we understand processes are our own limitations even there. I kind of wandered away. I don't know if I really got it good. Did I do a good? Okay. I'm going to just blame Mercury every opportunity.
Well, I think this question really came from me. So, because when Kayla sent out the Yamataka, when she sent us or gave us that Yamataka, all about the Yamataka, and the, there were quite a few references to going to being the void. I don't know if you guys read that piece. And the void has always been something to me that seemed like, I'm not sure I want to aspire to go to the void. You know, it was like that was my conversation with Kayla about that, and we had some good conversations about that. And this was very helpful to me.
Could
very
you?
Hateful. Hateful.
Blame Mercury. Don't listen to Sigmund Freud. He would say something else. He would say something about your discomfort with this concept.
Yeah, with this concept. And it is. Oh, it is. I mean, it's where I've turned my back several times on Buddhism. It's just this idea of, my tea wants to tip over too. That this is the most difficult concept for me, in the sense that void. I like the extremes. I understand that. I like the spaciousness. All the way you explained it is very helpful. But the idea of going to nothingness to me does not feel comfortable.
Right,
as
and it shouldn't.
As a soul,
and it shouldn't. And it shouldn't, because nothingness would be the nihilistic extreme of devoidness.
Right.
So. Nothingness was the nihilistic extreme, and the void, as in that great beatific space, would be the absolutist extreme.
Right.
Now, there's some place in between, which is... Now, one of the ways... Okay, I'll go there. One of the ways that this gets talked about in the context of meditation practice is that, there are two ways I'll go there. Well, this is taking longer than we usually take for this sort of stuff, but I'll stick with it. As Westerners, we think that sometimes we're awake, like right now, sometimes we're asleep and then we're dreaming, and sometimes we're sound asleep. And we think that when we're sound asleep, we're unconscious, as in there's no consciousness there. In traditional Asia, whether Hindu or Buddhist Asia, the view is that when you're sound asleep and you're not dreaming, you're conscious of nothing. Very different. Being unconscious and being conscious of nothing are two radically different ideas. If you go to Carlsbad Caverns, as Kay did on her 50th birthday, if you go to Carlsbad Caverns and they flip out the lights, you see what real darkness looks like, but your eyes haven't stopped working. But you literally can see nothing in a way which nobody understands until they've had that experience. We really don't know what darkness is like. So, dreamless sleep, from the Buddhist point of view, is awareness of nothing. And why is it awareness of nothing? It's because all the senses have shut down. We think of having five senses. Buddhists think of having six senses, the five we're used to, plus the mind, which they think of as being a sense organ. The mind is a sense organ that is aware of thoughts. The objects of the mind are thoughts and perceptions. Also, the mind is aware of what we see and hear. So, the mind is a sense organ that has objects. And when you're in dreamless sleep, then the mind and the other five sense organs have stopped functioning. But your consciousness has not stopped functioning. Now, if you can wrap yourself around what it is like to be conscious of nothing, then you can wrap yourself around the continuity of consciousness. Because, see, we think of consciousness goes flips on, flips off, flips on, flips off. I wake up in the morning, I'm conscious, I fall asleep, I'm unconscious. On, off, on, off, on, off. Buddhist view is there's no on-off of consciousness. There's just on, but there's different things that consciousness is aware of, or it's not aware of anything, but it's just there. Now then you can take it another crank, which is, so what happens when you die? So from their point of view, what happens when you die is the sense organs really cease to function, but consciousness doesn't cease to function. But it is not aware of anything in a different way than it's not aware when you're in dreamless sleep. Because when you're in dreamless sleep, consciousness is embodied, even if it's not aware of anything, because the sense organs aren't functioning. From the Buddhist point of view, when you die, consciousness is not embodied anymore, and something else is happening. And that is impossible to talk about, fundamentally impossible to talk about. The metaphor for it is, if you imagine, in the old days, you know, they had oil lamps, and an oil lamp is like a vessel that has a basin, and there's a wick on it, you know, like Aladdin's lamp, you know, there's a wick laying on it, and they'd say, okay, so you light the wick, and it's burning. So the Buddha asked this question. He said, okay, suppose you have an oil lamp which has consumed all the oil, and now it's burning the wick. And at the last moment, just before that light goes out, you take another oil lamp, which is fully charged with oil, with a nice fresh wick, and you touch that wick to the one that's just about to burn out, and it catches. And then the first lamp goes out. It's finally totally consumed the wick. So then the Buddha asks a question. He said, is this the same lamp? Is this the same light, the same flame? Is it the same flame, or are these two different flames? And he doesn't answer the question. He asks his disciples, is it the same flame, or is it different flames? Two flames or one flame? And he leaves them to contemplate that question. Because the answer to the question of whether consciousness persists from life to life is in the answer to the question, is that one flame or two flames? And he doesn't answer that because it's in that space where you can't talk about it, but you can come to know it in some way. And the first step for coming to know it is coming to terms with what does it mean to be conscious of nothing. So that's, I can't say anything more about it than that. Right. So I don't even remember how I got there. Why did I go there?
When you're saying nothing, are you saying conscious of devoidness, or you're
no? In this case, no. In this case, I'm saying conscious of nothing, because your senses aren't functioning. Devoidness would be your senses are aware, and you are deleting falseness from what you're aware of. Okay.
But you're not saying absolute zero.
Never.
You're saying nothing.
No, no, you're just not aware, but there's awareness, right? So awareness isn't gone, it just doesn't have any objects. Very hard to understand consciousness without an object, what that could possibly mean. Again, this is the place, you know, language leaves us because language works for the realm of material, emotional, psychological kind of reality where we have objects and subjects that can come together. But when you enter a realm where there are no objects and subjects that can come together, then our language doesn't work anymore. You know, so take it as a hypothesis. I mean, I'm not saying, this is not. I mean, it may be in the scripture, but I'm not like being some fundamentalist saying it's in the scripture. You have to believe it. What I'm saying is, this is what the Buddhist teaching about this matter is. And if you contemplate it, if you explore it, if you wonder about it, you ask yourself questions about it, then something else happens. I mean, when you wake up in the morning, it's like there you are. So how is that possible? I mean, it becomes very interesting to explore this phenomenon of continuity. I mean, because here we are. I was here yesterday, I'm here today. How is that possible if I disappeared when I was asleep? I mean, is that because my body was there? Okay, but that's not what defines me. So my mind went away and then it came back again? How is that possible that my mind went away and came back again? I mean, what's going on? I mean, so the Buddhists invite you to explore this. They kind of propose some gnarly questions that are kind of bugging questions. And then they invite you to get bugged and kind of look into these things. And, what comes up, what comes out of them. And explore. All right, I've been talking for an hour. I certainly didn't intend to do that.
I would just want to bring up one point on that, too. With one of the things that Chuji said is, I have tried the analysis. David is really adept at analysis part of Buddhist psychology. I much more have worked with visualization and so forth, and don't have the intellectual capacity I always thought. But lately I've been trying to do that analysis of, because I've had some fear come up, of where does that fear come from and who is it, what's there calling me inside. What I found it was I was getting very contracted with it, which is intense with it, like coming in. And so Chuji, when he was talking about the analysis, he was talking about it as you're coming down to a point, but then you're opening back up again. And he was doing that with his arms, the whole Friday night when he was talking about that, I kept thinking, that is one of the things that we talk about when we're doing meditation practice, too, is the whole thing about really relaxing deeply and staying alert. It's kind of trying to open up that way, open up our heart in that way, and not close down and get tense. So it's the same thing we have to do when we're doing analytical meditation, and it was a great discovery, like a light bulb went on, that what I always had to fight in doing meditation or visualization, that closing down and getting tense and trying to concentrate too hard, also is doing that with the analytical meditation. In both cases, you have to try and stay open with it. So,
I mean,
it's a profound experience for me this weekend.
Yeah, I find it immensely, immensely freeing. So I've been working with this idea of emptiness since, I don't know, 1977 or 78. This is one of the subject. This is the subject that I wrote my doctoral dissertation on. And you know, that's a long time ago, and still trying to understand in some way, now more experientially than intellectually, what's the reference here. It's freeing. I mean, it ties your head in knots at some points, but mostly it's a very freeing, and that's what its intention is to be liberating and freeing in certain ways. It bugs you for a while, 10 years. But you know, but it is, but you know, all good things have a price. But it is, it's freeing.
This emptiness, it seems like you struck on two different concepts or hypotheses tonight: the consciousness of nothing, and then the and then the emptiness. So
yeah, they are two different. In this way that I'm talking about it, they are two different things. I mean, you could apply the analysis of emptiness to the nature of consciousness, but we don't have time to do that tonight. But in this particular case, I was doing two things. One is I was talking about emptiness from the point of view of objects and creating spaciousness by emptying our ideas of objects. And in the other case, I'm talking about encountering the great mystery of our being without being analytic about it, but asking yourself a question about the unknown space within ourselves that we experience every 24 hours and looking at it in a different kind of a way. If you want me to bring those two together, I'll do that sometime, but not tonight. It's too much for tonight.
Yeah. You'll have and then we can get on the Comito website to hear Zachochi's talk. Here eventually for Friday night.
No,
they didn't record it.
They did, but I don't have it.
Yeah, but eventually. Haven't you put it on your web before for the other talks?
When he was up here, I've done it.
Oh,
but if you want, you could actually, you could write to them and ask them.
Well, I'm on their website, so I could just.
I don't think that they put that stuff on their website.
I'm on their email, but I could email them.
Yeah, you could email them and say, wow, you know, David and Kayla said that this is a real great talk. Can you get a CD of the talk to me? I'd really like to hear it. They might be able to do that for you. You know? It was. Also, his Saturday morning talk was very profound. It was very profound. It had a big impact on me.
Excellent.
So should we take a break?
I hope so. It's almost 8 o'clock.
And then come back and do some meditation practice.